And Elena Katz-Chernin and myself welcome you to the Little Wireless program. When I sat down here, when I first did the show, I had no idea that I'd still be here in 25 years, having interviewed almost everyone on Earth with any sizable amounts of little grey cells. At about the same time as I ensconced myself here, a comparatively young thespian in London was working out the choreography of a waddle, knowing that he had to base his character on its walk in much the same way as Chaplin worked out the waddle of the tramp. His name was, indeed is, David Suchet. It wasn't always David Suchet, as we'll get to in a minute. And on his bucket list, I know, he wants to play Willie Loman in my all-time favourite play, Death of a Salesman. Well, David, you've been on my bucket list for many years, and so it's a great delight to have you here.
Thank you very much.
But I'm not going to ask you about the Belgian detective. I want instead to ask you about what I think is the greatest of many extraordinary performances, and that is the character of Augustus Melmotte. I regard The Way We Live Now as one of the two or three best dramas ever out of the UK. Mm. And I think your performance of this 19th century version of The Wolf of Wall Street was simply, and is simply, breathtaking. And it's the opposite to the Belgian detective in every way, isn't it?
Yes, it's completely the opposite. Augustus Melmotte must... Well, his, if you watch the programme, you will see the complete embodiment of the evils of capitalism, the complete opposite to Hercule Poirot, who is one of the greatest of moral compasses.
Well, let's look at some of the ways. He is loud where Poirot is quiet.
Yeah.
He is vulgar. Even the way he eats is offensive, where, of course, your Belgian detective always picks at his food, yeah, you know, with great gentility. He is rapacious, greedy, where the Belgian detective is only needs enough money to live his refined, perhaps anally obsessive life. And I wonder at the time, given that Melmotte's ethnicity is vague, it's not quite specified, whether you or the producers were ever accused of anti-Semitism.
I think the book, when it first came out, was accused of anti-Semitism, and it is, there's no question about it that there is anti-Semitism within the book, and you can't do a faithful adaptation and move away from that. You have to say it is a drama, it is a novel of its time, of its day. The fact that it's rather, you could say, and it is said, for example, that one should not put on the play The Merchant of Venice because people say it is anti-Semitic. I've played Shylock twice now in my career, and although I will agree that there's anti-Semitism within the play in that you see how a person reacts and how he behaves, in an unsavory manner. Basically, if you study the play of The Merchant of Venice and compare it to what was going on down the road, which was The Jew of Malta by Marlowe, you realize that what Shakespeare was doing, actually, was giving a compassionate portrayal of Shakespeare.
Does not a Jew bleed?
Exactly
that. It is an astonishing piece of work. So is The Way We Live Now. Now, we should point out it's written by Trollope. You play this a ghastly creature who sits out to woo rich and powerful London investors. You find an appropriate investment vehicle in a hypothetical railway, railway service in the Americas, which is the work of a young engineer, Paul Montague. But Melmotte doesn't give a stuff about the train. And during his manipulation of excitements, the sort of things we saw prior to the global financial crisis, we have a vivid depiction of the dark side, or perhaps the soft underbelly of London privilege.
I based my character on his, what I thought to be his worldview, and I made his God money. And if he has in front of him and through those lenses only God equals money, and he worships his God, then irrespective of anybody else or their feelings, he will pay obeisance and follow and go for his God and serve that. And that's all he wants out of life. He wants money for him equals status. He comes from somewhere, we don't know, Middle Europe, we don't know from where he is. But we know that he's very much like, you can say, we saw bits of Melmoth in Maxwell, for example.
Another fellow you played.
Yeah. In fact, when I played Augustus Melmoth, I based a lot of his character on Maxwell.
I think we should point out to younger listeners who Maxwell was.
Well, Maxwell was a huge newspaper baron, and in England he owned the Daily Mirror. And his God was money as well. And although I based Augustus Melmoth a lot on Robert Maxwell, when I was asked to play Robert Maxwell, it really took me by surprise, because I had already studied him. The two amazing characters to play.
I've spent some months tweeting about the way we live now, before I knew you were coming to Australia, begging the ABC to rescreen it. Yes. And I point out to you, dear listener, that it is available from the BBC shop. And one of the things I found quite thrilling about it was the physicality of the production. Unlike many cosy dramas,
yes,
it has a physical energy. People stamp their feet, they vomit, they slop their food around.
Yeah.
It has, everything is physically expressed. It isn't simply words.
No. Well, we had a wonderful director, David Yates, an absolutely extraordinary director, who wanted to show society, not in its glorious elegance, but what, you know, we all wore the clothes of the society people of those days, but we behaved like the animals we really were, and as depicted by Trollope.
Okay. You've raised the issue of God, and we're going to spend quite a lot of time dealing with that very major character, who I don't think you've played as yet. I wonder if we could have a listen to David Suchet reading a very significant passage from the Bible.
Through him we received grace and apostleship, to call all the Gentiles to the obedience that comes from faith for his name's sake. And you also are among those Gentiles who are called to belong to Jesus Christ. To all in Rome who are loved by God and called to be his holy people, grace and peace to you from God our Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ.
David, am I correct? Is that the passage that gave you your Damascene conversion?
That is the beginning of Romans, the letter to the Romans and the Christians in Rome. And it was, in fact, reading that letter. And I read it in a very particular way, which I'll explain in a moment. It was reading that letter. Did I find my worldview, my glasses, or the lenses through which I could then see the world? I wasn't young. I was a man of 40 years of age. And I had always been searching for something beyond what there is now, because I really did believe for most of my life, if this is all there is, then what do we have? What is there? What is there beyond this? There must be something beyond this. And because I was a child of the 60s, I was born in 1946, I was a teenager growing up with the Beatles and all the rest of it, and they used to go to India to follow their gurus. They were searching on a spiritual level, so I was searching on a spiritual level. I didn't go to India and follow them. But it made me question, and I read books, the famous books, Castaneda and all that, The Man, and all those philosophies, etc., etc. I dabbled with Buddhism, and then I moved away from that. So in a sense, I was searching for something. But by the time I'd got to 40, I was a proclaimed, well, I was more on the side of atheism than I was on agnosticism. Agnosticism I always felt a bit embarrassed about because it's sitting on a fence, and that is always, whether you're a man or a woman, it's very uncomfortable.
It's a perfect definition of agnosticism.
I wanted to be one thing or the other, and I would have fallen on the side of being an atheist. I got to the stage when I looked at this world and it was so harsh and yet so beautiful, and the paradoxes of this planet and human behavior, I could not accept. I was in a hotel room. I was making a film called Harry and the Hendersons, actually, in 1986. And for some reason, which I cannot explain, I was drawn to think about life after death. I think I was thinking about my late grandfather, who had always been for me a sort of spiritual guide. And then I said, well, why do I think of him as a spiritual guide if I don't believe in life after death? And then I thought, wow, that's interesting. There must be a Bible here somewhere.
But there wasn't a Gideon.
But there was. There
you
wasn't.
Were in the only hotel room on earth without a Gideon.
So there was no Gideon's Bible by the side of my bed, so I lay awake all night thinking, I must be, as you say so correctly, I must be in the only hotel room in the world without a Gideon's Bible. So the next day I rang up a local Bible shop, and rather embarrassed way, I lifted the phone and I said, do you happen to sell Bibles? And he said, yeah, that's what we do here. Where can I help you, sir? And I said, well, no. I just wanted to know if I came to your shop, could I buy a Bible? It was almost like me asking for something pornographic. Anyway, I got this Bible, and I thought, I don't know where to read. I don't believe in Jesus Christ, because that's all phooey anyway, and I don't believe in all that nonsense. But I do believe, oh, yes, there was someone called Paul who actually did exist, who actually wrote letters. And I looked up his letters, and I thought, oh, well, I've always been interested in Rome. I've always been fascinated by Rome. I'll read his letter to the Romans. Most of it, I couldn't understand a word. But from halfway through to the end, I suddenly found him talking about a way of life, a way of being, a way of thinking, a way of behaving towards other people. And I, by the end of that letter, which I read, but I was going to explain to you how I read it. When I was a member of the Royal Shakespeare Theatre Company, the wonderful director, John Barton, used to say to me, when you get a Shakespeare play, believe it's just come through the letterbox and it's just sent to you and you've never heard about it and you've never read anything before. You've never read that play before. So when I read the letter to the Romans, the introduction that you said then, that you kindly let me read on your program, instead of saying to those in Rome, or to, I said, this is a letter to David Suchet. Paul is writing to me. I will read it as a personal letter. And by the end of that letter, I was so emotionally moved and thought, this is extraordinary, that I wanted to know who taught Paul. Where did he get this? And then I had a big problem. It was from Jesus. It was his teaching that he taught Paul. And where did he teach Paul? He taught Paul in the wilderness for 3 years. So I read, and I thought, that's a bit far-fetched, but never mind, I'll go with that. But so there I was left with a dilemma. I started to study the person or the personality of the biblical character, Jesus. And that really was a journey from 1986 until 2007, reading, studying, questioning, finding it hard to believe, going up and down, up and down, up and down. I call my journey to faith dragged, kicking and screaming, actually. And it wasn't until 2007 when somebody said to me, look, you're taking communion. Where were you confirmed? I said, I've never been confirmed. And they said, well, do you want to be confirmed? And I went home and I said to my wife, I've just been asked if I want to confirm my faith. And I thought about it, and I did pray about it. And I thought, well, you know what? It's time. And I did. It doesn't get rid of doubt, but it gives you a place to sit.
You're currently, well, your series on Paul, on your following in his footsteps, is currently screening here, and I want to get back to that a little later. But there's a scene, well, when you finally kill off Hercule. It reminds me of the last moments of Brideshead Revisited, when the wonderful Larry Olivier is lying back and he manages with his last atom of strength to cross himself right at the photo finish. So I'm looking at the death of Hercule, and that's coming back into mind. And I could well imagine you becoming a Roman Catholic. It would have seemed to me less surprising than you becoming an Anglican, because, as you know, they're often described, well, they're all agnostics, and they are also the conservative party of prayer,
yeah.
Neither of which would appeal to you.
No. And in fact, you hit me at a very extraordinary time of my life as a Christian. And this is the first time I'm actually going to talk about it. I find myself, as an Anglican, questioning where I should really be. And I find where the Anglican Church is, not Christianity, where the Anglican Church is a difficult place for me. And I'm beginning to look, actually, towards the original ancient church of, in fact, Eastern Orthodoxy at this moment.
Is that right? Mm. Is that right?
Not Anglo, not Catholicism, not the Latin West, but to go right back 2,000 years to the formation of the church in Antioch, which ended up as Eastern Orthodoxy.
Before you became an English, a proper English gentleman, I was mentioning in passing that the name Suchet derives from a name which literally translated means a kosher butcher.
Yeah.
What happened to you and Jewishness?
Well, it was an interesting, my name, actually, I might as well tell you what that name was. The family was Shochet, and Shochet, for those who do speak Hebrew, is the name for a butcher. That's what he is, Mr. Butcher. My family on that side, my father's side, came from Lithuania, a little Jewish shtetl, and they ended up in South Africa, and then my father, when he started to study medicine, he was brought up quite an Orthodox Jew. When he came to England and became a doctor, he gave up his faith. He didn't have a Jewish faith anymore. He looked inside the brain. He said, this is all there is. We're a man, and there's no divinity within man. And he had given up his faith. He married a Christian woman, my mum, and she was Church of England. And that was the end of the Jewish line, because the Jewish faith is handed down through the female line.
Yeah.
And that's where it's ended.
Yeah. Why, of all the variations on Christianity that are available in a crowded theological market, are you choosing, or are you contemplating choosing, Eastern Orthodoxy?
I wanted to go back to the original. In a sense, I wanted to go back to understanding the original doctrine, the teaching of the early, really early church, the old church fathers, who were actually the original church fathers, which go back to the first century, that were taught, in fact, by John the Divine, who wrote Revelations. And in contact, the closest you can get to apostolic teaching, those who were touching the apostles of Christ and what they then taught. Now, I'm well aware, and I'm very greatly distressed about institutionalized church, and I think that big church organizations, they get taken over. I've always said that Christianity may be the car, but often it's money and power that move it along. And one sees this in great big edifices like the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church. You see it all over the world, and you say, but is this religion? Is this God? And my answer is no, it's not God. We're looking at politics and power as much as institutionalized religion can be. The Orthodox Church actually is one of the few churches that has never been granted that. It's been too persecuted where it is. The Russian Orthodox Church under Stalin, for example, didn't stand a chance. It's never been an autocratic institution at all, and it's the only one that hasn't.
I am amongst many things. I collect icons, this from an atheist, And one of the reasons I love Russian icons, and indeed Balkan icons, is that implacability. They are humorless, they are confronting,
yes.
They are two-dimensional in
yes.
the way they are painted,
yes.
But they have a depth which really punches you right in the solar plexus.
And the iconography is a fascinating art. It's absolutely, it's captivating, and it captivates me. On one level, you can look at an icon, and you're looking at faces of Mary, of the apostles, of Jesus, and they almost look like cartoons. The Orthodox Church forbid the three-dimensional image, right? You'll never see a statue of Mary. You'll see her face that's painted flat on an icon. There was a time when there was a big movement against icons, but they are really mirrors through which you look into the heart and soul of the person rather than worship an icon.
Well, as an ex-atheist who has gone through this extraordinary spiritual journey, one you're clearly still on, are you now buying the entire package? What about the quite appalling social attitudes that are often a corollary of ancient faiths?
Yeah, absolutely appalling. I couldn't agree with you more, and I don't try and avoid what has happened in the past. Look at, for example, look at the Crusades done in the name of Christ. I mean,
Look at Holocaust, much of which was done in the name of Christ.
In the name of Christ. It is terrible what has happened and how religion has been hijacked for political and power purposes. And you then go back to the Gospels and you look actually at the figurehead of Christianity and Jesus himself, and that has nothing to do with what we are now talking about.
You have nonetheless searched your Jewish origins.
Yes.
I know this because I'm told, I haven't seen it, it's one of the few things you've done that I haven't seen, that you were on this program where you search for your roots. What's it called?
Who do you think you are?
Who do you think you are? What did you discover that you didn't know?
Well, it's not so much that first of all, one of the great things I discovered, I always was rather proud of the fact that I had French blood in me because I thought my name was Suchet. I knew it was derived from what I thought was a name that even came after Shocket when it was in South Africa, when they changed their name from Shocket to Sukadovich, the son of Shocket or Suchet, and it became Suchet. But at that time, when I was young and growing up, I thought that I had French blood in me, and I had none. That was one thing I discovered. I had no French blood at all, which was rather a shame. I didn't know about my name, Shocket, at all until that program. I didn't know I came from Mr. Butcher. I had no idea at all. And I had no idea that Mr. Butcher was so highly regarded in the Jewish faith. The rabbinical slaughterer and was responsible for selling or dealing out kosher meat.
I interrupt this program for an advertisement. This is LNL on RN. The program is devoted to David Suchet, as indeed I am. And you can listen to us on Radio Australia and on your podable device. Okay, David, all these threads, this warp and weft of religious and indeed irreligious beliefs comes to you. Here you are sitting opposite me. When you were sitting in your bath in Seattle, one of the things that was preoccupying you was mortality. Do you now believe that you, in some form or another, will survive death?
It's such an illogical thought, isn't it, that I thought when I was lying in the bath. Will I survive death? What is that all about? No, of course I won't survive death, I thought, as I was lying in that lovely warm water. And, as I mentioned earlier, my thoughts went to my late grandfather, who I'd always felt as some form of spiritual guide. So, lying in the bath, I look at the paradox within me. You'll hear me mention the word paradox quite a lot, actually.
Love paradox.
I think we have to learn to accept paradox in our lives. believing that there's no life after death. So why, David, do you keep thinking that you're being guided in spirit by your grandfather, who is dead. Oh, that's interesting, I thought. Why do I think that? And that's what really got me into thinking about the most famous person who they say had life after death, which was Jesus of Nazareth.
That's an answer. In other words, now you have, well, Manning Clark, the great Australian historian, just before he died, said when talking to me that he had a shy hope. I love that, a shy hope of an afterlife. That's what you have.
I think it goes back to the original Nicene Creed that was formulated in the year, of, I think it was 325 or something like that, where at the end he says, I look towards the resurrection of the dead and life everlasting. That's what the early church believed. The creed is there. And in so saying it, I believe it.
Okay. I should at this point mention why you are in Australia. And it's because you are playing in an extraordinary theatrical event, which is about death in very high places. It's about a murder in the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about it.
Well, I hasten to say it's about a possible murder in the Vatican. It's
called... Oh, you fence it up.
It's called The Last Confession, and we're doing a 12-week tour of Australia. We're going to the five major cities, Perth, Melbourne, Adelaide, Brisbane and Sydney. A great, great introduction for me to your country, I must say, having never been here before, which is a great mistake in my life, but at least I'm making up for it now. It's a play about the death, the untimely death of John Paul I on September the 28th. He was discovered actually on September the 29th at 4:30 in the morning, sitting up in bed, reading, stone dead, having been Pope for only 33 days. Now, I'm going to backtrack a little here and say that in 1976, there was a huge Roman Catholic council called Vatican II. I'm sure every listener will know or have heard of Vatican II. Basically, what Vatican II was the huge debate and decision to open the Catholic Church up to the world.
3 years for John 23.
Absolutely, absolutely. To open the windows of the Church to the world, to have closer communication with other religions, not to be so aloof, a new prayer book, etc., etc., etc. This Pope, John Paul I, was a direct result of that, and he was going to be the great liberal Pope. He was the smiling Pope. He was the people's Pope. He wanted to address contraception. He wanted to address test tube babies. He wanted to address celibacy. He wanted to address so many things that would revolutionize the Roman Catholic Church. Sound familiar? Oh, yes. We have Pope Francis, seemingly the people's Pope, the smiling Pope, who is more like a parish priest. And this was John Paul I. The conservatives in the Vatican, the Curia, were really against.
They were more than that. They were aghast.
They were against them aghast. That's very, very good.
Yes,
yes, against and aghast. I like that. That's very good. And on the day that he died, I mean, I remember the newspapers in London, the headlines, has the Pope been murdered?
Well, they were absolutely emphatic in Rome, because I can remember vividly seeing them. He was murdered.
There was no doubt. No. There's seemingly no doubt. And later, books were written about it, conspiracy books came out. And the writer, Roger Crane, who is a lawyer, a New York lawyer, never written a play before, was so captivated by this whole story, this whole conspiracy theory, that he investigated himself from a legal side and wrote this extraordinary play. And he discovered that there was a character in the Vatican at the time called Cardinal Giovanni Benelli. That's the part I play. And Giovanni Benelli was a great friend of Albino Luciani, who happened to be Cardinal of Venice, who became John Paul I. And not only was he a good friend of his, but my character was rather like a bulldog in the Vatican. He was a power broker, very unpopular. He was known as the Berlin Wall, Another description of him was the Kissinger of the Vatican, and he power broke his friend, really, into the seat of the papacy, because he believed in his heart that this is what the Roman Catholic Church needed. John Paul Albino Luciani, his great friend, this person was needed to change the Catholic Church. After 33 days, his friend is found dead. And my character goes through not only a crisis of faith, how can God take away such a wonderful pope, but he has a great crisis of faith in the Roman Catholic Church. And in fact, only 4 years after his friend died, did Giovanni Bonelli himself die of a great big massive coronary thrombosis in Florence, with very little faith in the Catholic Church, and having found his faith back in God, yes, but not in the Catholic Church. Very, and this play, it opens that fourth wall for the audience of the Vatican, and takes the audience into not a religious play at all, into a play of power politics. What goes on behind those walls?
Arguably the world's oldest and most successful multinational corporation.
Yes.
Thanks to the work of Paul, your very good friend. It is full of surprises. Every now and again, something absolutely unpredictable and anomalous occurs.
Yes.
The murder is not entirely anomalous. One suspects that there are precedents for this murder, if indeed it was a murder.
Well, there have been deaths in the Vatican prior to John Paul I, and one will never, ever know what goes on behind the walls of that great big institution. And this play, as I said, takes that fourth wall away.
The thing that almost as astonishing as his election and very, very short tenure is that of the incumbent pope. Coming back to Melmoth and the detestation of capitalism, here's a pope who was so radical, or so apparently radical, that he drives the American religious right crazy.
Well, because the current pope we're talking about, actually is trying to do something as radical as John Paul I did, which was actually to get down to saying what Christianity is all about, rather than feeding on the power of that great big organization behind him, which is why he is investigating the Vatican Bank, which is why he sacked a lot of people, which is why the church in Rome is worried about him even now.
Does the Eastern Orthodox faith require a little bit of stirring up?
I don't know the answer to that question. I haven't studied it enough to know that. It would say, when it's ever asked about modernizing itself, you know, should they be stirred up? They say, well, why? We don't need to be stirred up. We want to be actually unchanging. We want to stick to our roots. And you could argue, I suppose I could argue, although I don't know enough about it, and I'll admit that, that the roots are where most nourishment lies. And it's as the tree grows and branches are spread that trouble can occur.
I said we weren't going to talk about Hercule, but I simply must. I made a film some years ago with Peter Ustinov, who became a good friend.
A dear man.
Lovely fellow. But of course he got the character utterly and entirely wrong. And I think he would have to admit that now if he were to join us in the studio where he has sat. But I didn't know that you played, for heaven's sake, that you played the detective, the professional detective to his Perrault.
Yes, I did. To my shame, I say, I played Inspector Jabb to Peter Ustinov's Hercule Poirot. And I have gone on record, and I'll say it again, it does stand as possibly the worst performance I've ever given in my 45-year career, and I will...
I hereby absolve you of guilt.
I would also say that I am delighted I was so bad, and I'll tell you why. Because he went on to make several more films, and in those films, It was an American production, American series. They had the same cast returning. And if I'd have been any good, I would have continued to play Inspector Japp. And if I had continued to play Inspector Japp, the Agatha Christie estate would never, ever have even considered offering me the role of Hercule Poirot.
One of the reasons you've been so careful to ration the number of Poirots per annum has clearly been that you didn't want to be totally and utterly consumed by the character in the way, arguably, that my old collaborator Barry Humphreys has been by Dame Edna. It's a very tricky life, isn't it, for the actor who gets a wonderful job like that.
Yeah, and you have to, as an actor, well, I have to, as an actor, say no to certain things and yes to other things. And because I started my career in the stable of classical theatre, I was 13 years with the Royal Shakespeare Theatre, I was 10 years on the road in repertory theatre, because that was my stable, I didn't want any film career, television career, to nullify my other work. I never have been an actor, and I sit here to say to you honestly, I've never been an actor that sought fame. I've never been an actor to seek money. I'm not really interested in any of that. All I've been interested in is serving my writers, whether it be in theatre, film, television, or indeed great drama in radio. You mentioned Willie Loman. I'm actually going to play Willie Loman. I've just heard that they've offered me the role, not in the theatre, but on radio drama. And if we can do
nothing it... Nothing wrong with the wireless.
Oh, listen, nothing wrong with the wireless. And I'm so delighted that I may have... It's not actually signed yet, but it came through the door the other day, and I'm so excited at the thought of doing that. I actually turned down a series of Poirot to play John in Oleana in the theatre. Because it was... You know, Harold Pinter rang me and said he wanted...
There were long silences.
There were long pauses in that conversation. And it was something that I felt in my heart as an actor that I could not ignore. And I said yes to that. And when they rang up and said, look, would you play Poirot again? I said, I'm sorry, I'm already committed to the theatre.
I think I know Death of the Salesman almost off by heart. And one of the great joys of the programme was just before his death, I talked to Arthur Miller. And he described, I'm sure for the thousandth time, the opening night. And the curtain comes down on Willie's funeral. And silence. Miller remembers the silence lasting for 5 minutes.
Oh, right.
And he and the cast had a sense of dread. And then the applause started. Oh, right. And it hasn't stopped. Ever since, has it?
I think it's one of the greatest of world dramas.
Well, what I like about it is it democratized tragedy. In the past, tragedy was something that happened to gods, to kings.
Yeah.
And here it is happening to a salesman.
Yeah, a little man.
A little man. Yeah. He reminded me of my Uncle Ed, who was a traveling salesman. And for the first time, I realized that we had the capacity for tragedy and heroism amongst ordinary suburban folk.
Now, that was Miller's great gift to the world, that play. And the other play that I was so fortunate to be in, which is All My Sons, where I played Joe Keller. Very rarely have I found myself in so many magnificent dramas. And recently I've been in All My Sons, Long Day's Journey into Night, and now the thought of being Willie Loman is just so exciting for me.
Well, living in the Antipodes, I haven't been able to see you much on stage, but I do remember you did a wonderful version of Edward Teller in a drama about Oppenheimer. Now, by amazing coincidence, a new version of that story is going to air on American television this week.
Yes, so I believe, yeah. Well, I did it with the wonderful Sam Waterston, and it was, in fact, my first major television ever. And it was directed by a man called Barry Davis, who had to tell me, in those days we had multi-cameras and tape. It wasn't digital.
Yeah.
We had tape with multi-cameras with little red lights on, so we knew what was happening. And he had to tell me what those little red lights meant, and he had to teach me how to work in front of a camera. That was my very, very first experience.
But here, as you did with Melmotte, or as you did with Robert Maxwell, you were playing one of the most problematic of men.
Yeah, very complex. All my life I've been given given these very complex, problematical characters. I don't know why.
People with lots of little grey cells, well, the good or ill.
Well, I really enjoy them as well, because I love researching into human character, human persona, the way we are made up, the complexities, the paradoxes of the human nature. I really feed off all that. And the way I approached Melmoth, the way I approached Edward Teller, who was part of that great invention of the bomb that finally was dropped in Japan. I don't know, I just love the research into those sort of people and those situations and circumstances.
Well, of course, Teller didn't stop there. He became the great protagonist for the H-bomb. He was one of the great immoral monsters of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Are bad people more interesting dramatically?
Oh, unbelievably so. Yes, give me a really bad person to play every time, except for Hercule Poirot.
He is, in fact, a very sweet bloke. Now, what you have to deal with is something I've never seen before. I've never seen an actor so liked because of a character as you.
I know.
It follows you around, doesn't it?
It does, and it even follows me around with my first day in Sydney. Where people stopped me in the street and they called me by name, David Suchet, which is such a compliment, and telling me how much they love Hercule Poirot.
It can't be taken for granted. When Peter was here, we're working on our film, which was Grendel, the Beowulf legend, people would come up to him in the street and they'd mistake him for Burl Ives.
Oh,
It doesn't necessarily follow.
No, it doesn't. I do consider myself a very, very fortunate man and actor.
It's odd to me, because here is a character that by any objective measure should never have taken off. He's so odd, he's so peculiar. And yet people not only love him, but damn it, they love you because of him. Now, I've got a feeling that no one will tackle him again for 20 or 30 years. They wouldn't dare, would they?
Well, I think I'm going to disagree with you.
Do you?
Yeah.
You think someone else will have a go?
I'm sure. And sooner rather than later. I think we're in the world of show business, with the emphasis on business. And while that character, what I may have done is bring him to such a notoriety, in a sense, of such a position of public recognition, that I think that will be traded upon. And there will be other Poirots. There's got to be other Poirots now, because he's such a huge character for the world.
Well, everyone's played him, it would seem, at some time, if it's not Peter. I didn't realise that Charles Laughton
did indeed play him.
One of the greats.
Yes, I think it was in The Murder of Roger Ackroyd in London in about 1930, and was a great Poirot. And there will be other Poirots. There's got to be other Poirots. There were other James Bonds. There were, you know,
including in Australia, and people forget David Niven.
Yes. Oh, yes, indeed. Indeed.
Camino Royale.
Yes.
A forgotten film.
Yes. I have to learn to not only let go, but I have to really embrace all who play Poirot. Peter Ustinov was a great example to me.
Peter played Peter.
Oh, he played Peter, but what he did do, when I started to play Hercule Poirot and suddenly shot to fame in that role, he was so encouraging, he was so generous.
Oh, he's a darling.
He was
darling,
he was the sweetest man. Darling man, yeah. And for that I was so grateful. And we appeared on television together, and he said to me on a chat show once, he said, "Look at me. I could never be Hercule Poirot, but look at that chap over there, David Suchet. I mean, put a moustache on him and he is Hercule Poirot."
And indeed he was. And I find there was a lovely doco that you did after his official death, which we all looked at with fascination. And the way you put him together, detail by detail, this forensic scrutiny, but it went to the text. This is like you and the Bible.
Yeah.
You're very much into the text.
I'm into the
honor
text.
To the text.
Because that's my stable where I grew up. I grew up studying Shakespeare, and I had wonderful teachers in John Barton, Trevor Nunn, teaching me that everything is in the text. And the reason, my raison d'etre for being an actor, is to serve my writer, not to serve myself. Now, the way I can serve my writer and be a voice for my writer is to study meticulously the language they give me.
Are you such a paragon of thespian virtue?
No, I'm not. I'm not a paragon of any virtue, but I am there to serve my writer, because some people write to be read, some people write to be performed. Neither is more important than the other, but both have a place. And if a writer writes to be performed, they have no voice, they have nowhere to show their work without an actor. And therefore I take my job and my work incredibly seriously, and I will refuse to make light of what I do.
And yet, people forget that you can be very, very funny. You've been a very good comic actor in your time. Blot on the Landscape, is that still remembered?
It was remembered yesterday in Sydney. Walking around, I was being photographed near the waterfront, and I was stopped by a man who said, "Ah, I remember your Blot on the Landscape," and it shocked me so much we couldn't continue photographing. And I said, "Goodness me, you remember that?" And he said, "Oh, yes." And I was so grateful. It seems that one person, anyway, does remember it.
I was a great devotee of another wonderful actor, and Johnny Weissmuller, who, as you remember, played Tarzan.
Yes, yes.
And I stumbled across you in, of all things, a Tarzan film, one that showed much greater reverence to the text than any of the Weissmuller films. But there you were, jumping around in the jungle.
I was, but I wasn't pretending to be Tarzan. I remember that wonderful film, Greystoke, and I was asked to...
It wasn't too bad, actually.
It wasn't too bad, but I was right at the beginning of the film, because I ran this very seedy sort of nightclub bar in the jungle of all places. And if you ever see the beginning of this film, I have a very brief appearance at the beginning. Had all these wonderful, beautiful black actresses sort of sprawled all over me, and then there was a fire and my whole nightclub went up in fire. And there were a lot of Royal Shakespeare actors in that film.
It was a who's who.
It was a who's who.
A night of thespians.
But I have to tell you, because of money in that film, I was never allowed to be flown out to Africa for the burning of my jungle nightclub. So we did it in the studio, but the exterior shots all happened in Africa. And I'm here to tell you that they had to do retake after retake, because the company ran out of the burning shouting, "Oh! La Souche! La Souche!"
Oh, dear. Now, I know you've got to go on to do much more important things in this little wireless program, but I have to ask you about your activities regarding waterways.
Oh, my goodness me. You really have done your research on me. Thank you for that. My work on waterways, the waterways of Great Britain, the canals and rivers of Great Britain, which I believe are one of the jewels in its crown. Why do I believe that, and why do I feel that? Because in 1973, still being in the middle of courtship with my darling, was to become my darling wife,
Sheila. Who's in this production, playing a nun.
Yes, she's playing a nun. She said, "Listen, we're both fed up of theatre digs. We've both fed up of bars and fires and naked light bulbs. Why don't we live together on a boat? The canals of Great Britain, all over the industrial towns where there are repertory theatres, and we could live and we could go and have our career on a narrow boat." And that's what we did. From 1974, for 6 years, we lived on a narrow boat, chugging our way through the canal system to each of our repertory theatre jobs. Now, I'm here to say that in those days, the canals were just being at the beginning, well, half in the beginning, really, of their restoration. But everybody was so good to us and so kind to us that when I became more famous and I had a voice, I wanted to support the restoration of the British canal system. And I took upon myself to be part of a body of people that went to lobby Parliament and to try and stop road builders building roads that stopped restoration. And
this is where a little bit of fame is a great help.
Well, if you can use it to a good cause, then, you know, you should. You really should.
Are you winning?
Yeah, we did. We got a white paper through. Now we're fighting the high-speed railway that's going to be built in Great Britain, and we're trying to stop that now going through the canals.
And yet, I must say that one of the things I loved about Hercule was the fantastic graphics, the Art Deco graphics, including that thrusting, pulsing train rampaged across the screen.
They were brilliant. Well, I never saw
them. The art direction of that series was your co-star.
Yeah. Now, I absolutely would agree with you. I hadn't seen those graphics until I watched the very first program. And I remember sitting with Sheila. We were watching the program. And I said, look at this.
Yeah.
It was wonderful. I think it won a BAFTA.
Well, it bloody well should have. I have so enjoyed our brief encounter, David Seagate.
Oh, so have I.
Thank you very much for coming in. And I hope you break a leg with the new play, which I should point out, dear listener, has been greeted with a very wide range of responses, up to and including very much hostility. You don't mind that, do you?
If theatre doesn't provoke, it has no place.
Okay, beloved listeners, do not miss David Suchet in The Last Confession. No excuses will be accepted. Touring nationally from this Saturday, when it opens in Perth, and all details will, yes, be on LNL's website. On our next show, God help us, the slam poet Omar Musa will be doing some slamming for us. We are nothing if not eclectic. And we'll also discuss the untold story of Australian science to mark 100 years of, yes, Aussie science. Stick around for the news now on RN, and I'll be back with you in 23 hours.